The investigation itself needs to be investigated. At what point does an investigative failure become an accountability problem? That is the question Mississippi authorities now have to answer in the death of Nolan Wells. The most troubling part of this case may not simply be what happened to Nolan. It may be how many obvious questions remain unanswered and how much public pressure it has taken to force those questions into the open. Nolan went to Horn Island with friends on July 4th. His friends came back with his phone and keys, but Nolan did not. 2 days later, Nolan's body was found in the water, and yet authorities initially indicated that they did not suspect foul play. That is where scrutiny of this investigation should begin. Those circumstances did not prove Nolan was murdered, but they were more than sufficient to justify treating the people who were last with him as the primary suspects until evidence eliminated them. A suspect is not a convicted person. Suspicion is where an investigation begins. Evidence determines where it ends. So what evidence eliminated Nolan's friends as suspects before authorities publicly indicated that foul play was not suspected? Why weren't Nolan's friends treated as the prime suspects? Strip away everything social media subsequently uncovered and look only at what investigators had in front of them. A young man traveled to an isolated barrier island with friends. Those friends returned without him. His phone and keys returned with them. The explanation was that Nolan voluntarily remained on Horn Island and planned to return another way. Nolan subsequently turned up dead. Under what reasonable investigative standard are the people who were among the last known to be with him not the first people whose accounts must be aggressively tested? That does not require an arrest or criminal charge. It requires investigation. Separate them. Interview them independently. Preserve their original statements. Establish exactly when each person last saw Nolan. Determine who possessed his belongings. Compare their timelines. Secure relevant digital evidence. Authenticate their videos. Examine location histories. Inspect the boat. Investigate the distress call. Then try to disprove their accounts. If the evidence corroborates them, eliminate them as suspects. That is investigation. The problem is that the public was hearing that foul play was not suspected before many of these questions had been publicly resolved. The issue is therefore not whether Nolan's friends are guilty. It is what evidence justified minimizing the possibility of foul play so early. Nolan's phone was in a friend's possession. This fact should not be softened. Nolan's phone did not simply return to the mainland. It was recovered from one of Nolan's friends on the mainland. That matters. Nolan was missing, and one of the people who had been with him was in possession of one of the most important potential pieces of evidence concerning his disappearance. That should have generated immediate investigative scrutiny. Why did the friend have Nolan's phone? When did that friend take possession of it? Did Nolan voluntarily leave it? When did the friend realize Nolan was missing? When was Nolan's family told that the phone was in that person's possession? Was the device unlocked or accessed? Were messages, photographs, or other data deleted? What does its location history show? What do application records, cloud records, and forensic artifacts show? Reporting has indicated that some messages were deleted, although that alone does not establish who deleted them or when. That is precisely what forensic examination is supposed to determine. Possession of Nolan's phone does not prove that his friend harmed him. But a missing teenager's cell phone being found in the possession of one of the last people known to have been with him is evidence that demands investigation. And yet, weeks into the case, the phone's forensic examination was still caught in a dispute over how that examination would be conducted. For a device capable of reconstructing communications, movements, and potentially Nolan's final hours, that delay deserves scrutiny. The phone is not merely one of Nolan's possessions. It is potentially a digital witness. The "we're sinking" call and the boat. Then there is the boat. A distress call was made to CETO on July 4th. The caller reportedly said, open quote, "our bilge pump stopped working. We're sinking." Close quote, "water was reportedly entering the vessel. GPS coordinates were provided and assistance was requested." The dispatcher reportedly asked whether everyone was aboard and safe. The caller said everyone was aboard and in good health. The tow was subsequently canceled after the boat owner indicated that assistance had been obtained elsewhere. That sequence should have created an immediate physical evidence investigation. If the boat was taking on enough water for someone to say, "We're sinking," what exactly happened to it? Was the bilge pump actually malfunctioning? Was it inspected? How much water entered the vessel? Was there structural damage? Was the condition of the boat photographed before repairs? Who provided the alternative assistance? Was that person interviewed? What did that person observe? A distress call involving a supposedly sinking boat is not an insignificant detail when the same trip ends with one passenger missing and subsequently dead. The call may have been completely legitimate, but legitimacy should have been established through evidence, and the boat problem connects directly to the explanation for leaving Nolan behind. According to the account given publicly, Nolan voluntarily remained on Horn Island because he intended to return another way. Then, who was supposed to bring him back? Was that person identified? Was that person interviewed? Did Nolan communicate with them? Was there a text or call? Did another independent witness hear Nolan say he was staying? And why would Nolan voluntarily remain on a remote island without his phone or keys while the people he arrived with departed aboard a boat that had supposedly been experiencing a serious emergency? Maybe that happened exactly as described. But an investigation should not begin with maybe. It should begin with corroboration. A video is not a timestamp. Videos have also become important to the public reconstruction of Nolan's final hours. But a video does not establish a timeline merely because somebody says when it was recorded. If video is being relied upon to establish where Nolan was during a critical period, investigators should have obtained the original files and examined their metadata where available. Creation time, modification history, device information, location metadata, continuity with other photographs and videos, comparison with messages, GPS information, phone activity, and witness statements. A video presented without an independently verified timestamp may show that an event occurred. It does not necessarily establish when it occurred. That distinction matters when minutes and hours can determine whether competing accounts are credible. Digital sleuths should not have to establish that standard. Investigators should already have done it. The autopsy created another serious problem. Then there is the forensic handling of Nolan's remains. Nolan's family obtained an independent autopsy, but by the time their pathologist examined him, key organs and important neck structures had already been removed or retained during the initial examination. The consequence is significant. The independent examiner could not personally examine all of the anatomy that might have helped address important questions concerning drowning or possible injury. The independent examination ultimately classified both cause and manner of death as undetermined. That does not establish homicide, but it also does not provide the definitive medical explanation that would resolve the circumstances of Nolan's death. The issue is not whether organs or tissue may legitimately be retained during an autopsy. They can be. The issue is what happened in this case. What exactly was retained? Why? Where is it now? What testing was performed? Was everything properly documented? Why were crucial organs unavailable to the family's independent pathologist? Can the retained material still be independently examined? When one forensic examination materially limits what a second pathologist can independently evaluate, transparency becomes even more important. The answer cannot simply be, trust the process. The answer has to be, show what the process did. Why is the internet doing the pressure testing? This is where the investigation becomes an accountability issue. Nancy Grace, independent investigators, influencers, and digital sleuths have spent weeks interrogating the publicly available story. What happened to the boat? Why was CTOW called? Why was the tow canceled? Who provided assistance instead? Why did Nolan remain behind? Who was supposed to retrieve him? Why was Nolan's phone in a friend's possession? What happened to the deleted digital material? What time were the videos actually recorded? What happened during the critical period before the boat departed? These are not extraordinary questions. They are basic investigative questions. And law enforcement possesses something Nancy Grace and social media do not: police power. Investigators can obtain warrants and subpoenas. They can preserve physical evidence, request telecommunications records, conduct forensic examinations, document chains of custody, and formally interview witnesses. Internet investigators have fragments. Police have access to evidence the public may never see. That is why an active investigation should be ahead of the internet, not appearing to follow behind it. If investigators had already reconstructed the timeline, inspected the boat, established the chain of possession for Nolan's phone, authenticated the videos, and tested the witnesses' accounts before these questions exploded online, then the investigative record should eventually demonstrate that. If those steps happened only after public pressure, that tells a different story. That chronology matters. If someone possessed Nolan's phone, establish exactly what happened to the device while it was outside Nolan's control. If a video establishes a supposedly crucial moment, authenticate when it was recorded. If several people witnessed the same event, interview them separately and compare their accounts. The objective is not to prove the first story investigators receive. The objective is to determine whether that story survives investigation. And yes, race belongs in this conversation. Now reverse the races. Imagine a young white teenager travels to an isolated Mississippi island with black friends. The black friends return without him. One of them is later found in possession of his cell phone. His keys return without him. Their boat had generated a distress call saying they were sinking. The rescue was canceled. The explanation is that the white teenager voluntarily remained behind without his phone or keys. 2 days later, his body is recovered. Would those black friends have received the same initial benefit of the doubt? Or would they have immediately become the prime suspects until investigators eliminated them through evidence? That question cannot simply be dismissed as inflammatory. It goes directly to whether suspicion is applied equally. Mississippi also does not enter this conversation without history. The state has a documented history of racial terror against black people, failures to prosecute violence against black victims, and notorious instances of law enforcement complicity in racial violence. That history does not prove Nolan was lynched. It does not prove his friends killed him. It does not automatically prove that today's investigators are concealing what happened. But it explains why Mississippi authorities cannot reasonably expect unquestioning trust when a black teenager dies under unresolved circumstances and the initial investigative posture appears to have favored an innocent explanation. Bias does not require somebody consciously deciding, "I am going to protect these people because they are white." Institutional bias can operate through assumptions. Who instinctively looks suspicious? Whose explanation sounds believable? Who is immediately treated as a potential perpetrator? Who receives the benefit of the doubt? Which victim's death triggers immediate suspicion? Which one is initially interpreted as an accident? That is the deeper racial question surrounding this investigation. Would exactly the same facts have produced exactly the same investigative response if the races had been reversed? If the answer is no, then the problem is not merely perception. It is unequal justice. Now, the investigation itself needs to be investigated. At this point, Mississippi authorities do not merely have to explain what they believe happened to Nolan. They should eventually have to demonstrate how they reached that conclusion. When were Nolan's friends separately interviewed? When were inconsistencies identified? When was the boat examined? When was its alleged mechanical failure documented? When was the CETO call investigated? When was the person who supposedly provided alternative assistance interviewed? When was Nolan's phone secured? When was its chain of possession established? When was deleted digital information investigated? When were the videos authenticated? When was the explanation that Nolan voluntarily remained behind independently corroborated? Most importantly, were those investigative steps already underway before Nolan's family, Nancy Grace, independent investigators, and social media began forcing these questions into public view? Investigators are entitled to protect sensitive information while a case remains active. They are not entitled to rewrite the chronology afterward. If authorities were doing this work from the beginning, the investigative record should prove it. If they were not, public pressure did not interfere with the investigation. Public pressure exposed its weaknesses, and that distinction may ultimately be as important as the final conclusion itself. What did authorities know? When did they know it? What evidence did they secure? What did they verify? What contradictions did they investigate? what evidence eliminated the people who returned without Nolan as suspects? And the question that now hangs over the entire investigation, were Mississippi investigators searching for the truth before the public forced them to, or were they protecting an old racial bias tradition? Nolan Wells did not need influencers to become detectives. He did not need Nancy Grace to conduct the interrogation the public expected from police. He did not need his family to conduct a parallel investigation simply to force obvious questions into the open. He needed investigators to be suspicious first, follow the evidence second, and reach a conclusion last. Anything less is not an investigation worthy of public trust.